brought up in Winnipeg, and I joined the militia in 1932, I guess it was. I was only 17 years old, and was a machine gun battalion. And a bunch of us got into this, and we took quite an interest into it, in it, and we used to go out every Thursday night to barracks and have our parades and our machine gun drills. And I was in up until 1936. I had gone to different schools. I went out to Shiloh Camp in the summer for camp. Went out to Sarcee for a month in Calgary. And I went to schools at Port Osborne Barracks at nights, and I got through as a sergeant instructor at Small Arms. And then I got a job up north working in the mines, so I had to leave the militia. I worked up north for 3 years, and in 39, when the war broke out, and I just felt that I should go and join up with my old regiment, you see. However, in the meantime, the 10th Battalion Machine Guns had joined up with the Winnipeg Grenadiers under the name of Winnipeg Grenadiers. So the boys that I had known in the militia were now in the Grenadiers. So by this time, the Grenadiers had moved into Tuxedo Barracks. And I went up there and joined up. And they weren't going to let me in because I had a cartilage removed from my knee. So the doctor turned me down, put me in a lower category. And I went up to see Nobby Clark, the captain of my original company. He was a company captain in the Grenadiers. Mm-hmm. And I told him about it. Well, he says, we can't have this. Let's go over and talk to the doctors. So he went over and he talked to the doctors, and they put me through and allowed me to join up. So I joined as a private.
You didn't maintain your own?
No, my qualifications didn't seem to bother them at all. They didn't accept them. I remember taking the papers down and showing the qualifications, but that just brushed it off. Well, there was a lot of friction in the NCOs, you see, and they wanted their friends up advance and things like this. So the best they could do for me was make me a Lance Corporal. And I remember a sergeant called me out when we went out on drill one day. We were on machine gun drill. And the sergeant, who had been a private when I was in the militia, he called me out to take over the class. So I gave them instruction in sighting the machine gun and how to spot targets on this landscape target that was set up in the distance. You see, you use a clockwork method for 12 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 3 o'clock, and he would pick the target out on that respect. And everybody was quite surprised that I was able to do this, you see, and they said, gee, that guy knows his stuff. I didn't think any more of it. And that was the last I was ever. I wasn't too bright on the parade square. I wasn't a parade square soldier. These boys had been training and polishing and everything. They had been in it since September, and this was in February when I had got into it. And they were real sharp with the rifle drill and everything while I'd been away from all this, and so when they called me out to be a marker, I guess I didn't do as good a job as I was supposed to do. And so maybe this was one of the reasons why I wasn't accepted.
As a sergeant?
Yeah. I know there was a Sergeant Major Wiley there. He told me, he says, look, he says, don't go with them. Stay with the reinforcements. Stay with me and you'll get someplace. This was when we were going out to Jamaica. And I said, no, I'm going to go with the boys. So we went down to Jamaica. And Jamaica was a good, we had a lot of fun there. It was a good camp. We had no idea where we were going. The Germans had a better idea than we did. because they were broadcasting and going for grandeurs for going to Jamaica. Well, we were all in wonder. We were issued tropical clothing, and we thought perhaps it was South Africa, North Africa we were going to, you see. But we finally wound up in Jamaica, and we took on 18 months of prison camp guards down there. We would work for 3 months on guard duty, then we would go for a month and rest up at in the mountains at a place called Newcastle, you see. And there was a bit of a drill feed there. We would do some infantry training, but not too much. And we were supposed to get out and get a certain amount of exercise every day. There was a swimming pool, and there was lots of roads to go hiking on. And I was quite a road runner at the time, and I used to go in training for running long distance. And on our 1st of July sports day down in camp, I won the half mile and the 1 mile race that we had on the set. Then we put on an exhibition lacrosse game. Now, I wasn't much of a lacrosse player, but none of us were, so we got out just to show the Jamaicans some type of Canadian game, you see. Or there was all kinds of sports going on. I didn't go in for the 100 yards dash. There was too much competition there, and it was too much all at one day to go into too many races and take in too many events. However, after all our fun in Jamaica, we were shipped back to Winnipeg in various groups. I was just with the second group that came back, and we were pretty much on leave the whole time we were back in Winnipeg until the final company came back and they made preparations to ship us out to Vancouver.
They didn't train you at all after you came back to Winnipeg?
Very little.
So the only training you got was in Winnipeg before you left, and your training previous?
Yes. They took our machine guns away from us, all the things that we had been training with, and they gave us Bren guns, which we were not familiar with when we were on prison camp. We also had Lewis guns, which are obsolete. And a Lewis gun loads differently than a Vickers gun. A Vickers, you have to pull the cotton candle twice, but a Lewis gun, you only pull it once. And if you pull it twice, it fires. And this occurred several times when the boys were unfamiliar with the dancing. They thought they were loading the gun, and they would fire off a shot over the prisoner's head. And a shot would go off, and everybody would be on the alert, wonder what the hell had happened. As a matter of fact, one of the huts had put up a Nazi flag in their hut, and you could see it through the window. And one of the boys on guard duty took offense to this. So he shot at it. It was a bit of an eruption over that, but there were little things like this that occurred. I remember another fellow being very soldierly-like. He was on duty at a little bridge that we come across to go to the internment camp, and he had to stand guard there at night, you see. Stop who goes there was his orders, and if they don't stop, shoot. And his cousin, just a young kid, he was a runner. He had a bicycle to run messages back and forth between the camp and the prison camp. So he'd come racing back, his knees on his bike, and his cousin jumps out, "Halt, who goes there?" And the kid didn't stop. He fired his rifle at his own, he knew damn well who it was, but he was just carrying out orders. He was up on the carpet, but he got away with it.
I was going to tell me he shot him.
Yeah.
So then he came back to Winnipeg, and I understand there was more recruiting then, wasn't there?
Yes, there was. They gave us a bunch of recruits. We see our battalion was 750 strong, which was a machine gun battalion. But we were too small a battalion to stand the guard duties at Jamaica, so they brought in a larger battalion. They had enlarged the prison camp by this time. And They brought in another 1,000 men, I believe, that took over from us. And we came back, and they boosted our strength to about 1,000 men, I guess, with what was left of the garrison. Now, this didn't go over too good with the reinforcements, because Paddy Keenan, our RSM, said over TV that we got the sweepings of the garrison. Now, a lot of the boys got real mad about this, because they were well trained in the modern weapons, which we were not. They knew about brain guns and rocket throwers and everything else, but we had and anti-tank rifles and Tommy guns. These were issued to us, but we had never had the chance to use them on our way over. So they tried to train us in these things on the boat. With restricted space and everything else, it was pretty difficult. And no instructors, because nobody knew what they were teaching. Just had to try and pick it up as you went. However, when we landed in Hong Kong, there was an artillery range right out on the border of the territories. Now, the Japanese held the territories from Canton right down to the Hong Kong territories, and they were massed on the border. And we used to go out there, the boys who were selected as instructors would go out there and train in anti-tank rifles, Bren guns, Tommy guns, and the Limeys that were there, they were showing us how to use these weapons. They said, now you boys better make good scores, because the Japs are just over there watching with their spy glasses to see how we're doing. We were right at the border. Come back to Winnipeg. Kowloon to Castle Peak.
Kowloon Railway to Bridge.
This is the border here in the new territory.
Shamshan. These names don't mean anything to me. I don't. The Indian troops from India were all stationed in pillboxes through this area. Mm-hmm. They were supposed to withhold the Japanese until we got back and protected Kowloon and the island of Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. But the Japanese just seemed to walk through without any problems at all. I've got some. Oh yeah, this is Kowloon and Island of Hong Kong, Aberdeen. This is where I was on duty. We were supposed to be guarding an American battalion. I don't know how they got in there, but they had field guns. And we were situated on this island, overlooking them with our brain guns, and we were supposed to drive off any Japanese that might come and try to attack this gun position. And finally, they withdrew us. It was Fort Stanley. There was a big gun out here pointing out to sea, Middlesex, Royal Rifles of Canada. Oh yeah, Defense, Volunteer Defense Corps and Royal Artillery. This gun couldn't be turned around and used in any way against the Japanese attack. They had attacked from Kowloon. They come across this, it's about a quarter of a mile across at this point, I think, and they, or at this point, yes. Yeah. This is where they crossed, and there was a bunch of Hong Kong volunteer defense holding at that point. Mm-hmm. Apparently they didn't do too good a job of it, and the Japanese got on and pushed their way right through the island. And Bennett's Hill. We had quite a battle on Bennett's Hill. up until the 24th of December. And then we were withdrawn down to Aberdeen, and from there we got directions to go to, we were a platoon only, mm-hmm. to rejoin our company. Everybody heard that I had been killed, and so they had gone through my kit and stole everything I had of any value.
Getting back to the garrison duty, did you, was there a time, like when you got to Hong Kong, there wasn't hostilities yet, so was it...
That's right. This was a very interesting time for us. We were there about sometime in November, 25th perhaps, mm-hmm. and we got our first pay in Chinese money, which was great big sheets of paper, and it was worth nothing, you know. You could, when we translated into our money, we were getting a real bargain. It would cost us $3.50 for a steak dinner at Jimmy's Australian Steakhouse, which amounted to about $1.75 in our money, or something like this, you know. It was, we'd go downtown to the YMCA and have tiffin, where they would bring you a pot of tea and set a bowl of dainties on the table there, you see, and you just ate what you want off of this bowl and drank your tea, and when you were finished, the waitress would come and she would count the cookies that were left, and you paid for what you had eaten. And, there was places to drink and things like that. I remember going to one dance, but it wasn't very effective. You couldn't socialize too well, and but we were just getting to know our way around Victoria City, which most of the entertainment was. We would take the ferry across from Kowloon. It would cost us a nickel in Chinese money to go across. Actually, it was as cheap to go from our camp down to the ferry by taxi as it was to travel by streetcar here in Winnipeg, you know, and cost us 50 cents or something. And we even tried rickshaw rides, but this was too slow. There was one incident where some of the boys were coming back to camp and they were late on their pass and they were trying to make these rickshaw runners hurry. They were hollering, chop, 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 chop. And so one of the fellows was losing the race. He got mad, he got out of his rickshaw, put the runner in the rickshaw, and he pulled the rickshaw to the camp gate to get there before the others. He was never drunk, you know.
So before the war started, there was actually good times.
Excepting it was the horrifying conditions. Now, as soon as it started to get dark, it got dark about 7 o'clock there, it being near the tropics, and everybody was starting to go to bed on the street. The Chinese in there was tremendous. It was just crowded, and they had no place to live. And the rooms were all crowded full of people, relatives and friends and everything, and they just overflowed, and the overflow slept out on the street. And in the mornings, they were dying of malnutrition and various diseases, and there were trucks would come around and pick up the dead ones and take them to a common grave, I suppose, somewhere. I don't know. This was kept very quiet. It was just... But the refugees from Canton and Japanese captured territories had all come into Hong Kong, you see, and into Kowloon. How they survived, I have no idea. And I remember when we were finally moved into Sam Shapo camp, the Japanese made a big effort to evacuate Hong Kong, get all these refugees out. And for days on end, there were just one after the other going up this road, up over the hill, carrying their belongings, just straight parades of them. Mm-hmm. Thousands and thousands. Where they all went to, I don't know.
Well, when you went to Hong Kong, your barracks was Sham Shui Po.
Yes, that's right. We were put into this barracks, Sham Shui Po, and this is for our training point. And we were so busy in training the instructors that we had very little time to train the troops. And then it was, I guess it would be the 6th of December over there. It was a Sunday. Or the week prior to this, we had been given instruction of where our posts were to be for the defense of Hong Kong, you see. And our particular company drew this spot up on the mountain on the far side of Hong Kong. And not at Bennett's Hill, although Bennett's Hill came into our area, but each company was moved to its location, just to familiarize ourselves with where we would be if there was an attack. And on the following Sunday, which was the day before Victoria Harbor, we were all issued live ammunition, packed the full war pack, put on our gas capes, rolled them all up, and everybody was prepared and marched out to our spots prepared for Japanese attack.
So you
Where they got word of this, I have no idea. But we knew before Pearl Harbor that there was could be an attack. And we were all sent out to our positions. Then on the Monday morning, Japanese aircraft came over, did some bombing, dropped some leaflets, and they advanced over the border and attacked the Indian troops and gradually fell back. And our D Company stayed in Shamshipo. They were eventually evacuated on about the last ferry to come across from the mainland onto the island of Hong Kong. So from there, our defense of Hong Kong just went all to hell. They had quite a war headquarters there. It was dug right down into the mountain for a command headquarters. And they had ammunition and a lot of stuff stored down there. And they had pillboxes around, which had been built by the Chinese, but hadn't been built up to specification, and they just blew apart. They weren't very defensive at all. So it was a lot of the British troops that were manning these pillboxes, and they didn't stand up to the shock of shell at all. They just blew apart.
Most of your defenses were on the south side, weren't they, facing the ocean?
Yes, we were expecting the attack from the south, from the sea, instead of from the mainland. But there was very little from the sea. I remember there was some shelling at night from Japanese boats that stood quite a piece out, and they shelled the island. There were some shells, naval shells, that fell around our post. But there's no direct hits or anything. And we were up on Mount Cameron. Oh, this was later on. Yeah, we were up on Mount Cameron, and the Japanese. Where is Mount Cameron? One side gap. Why, the Japanese were over across the valley, and they had good little field guns, which they could dismantle and carry in pieces wherever they wanted to in the mountains. And they had the Indian troops carrying this equipment for them. You see, they would set these cannon up, and they were very accurate with it, and they bombed hell out of us on Mount Cameron. And all we had to try to return was a Bren gun. Finally, we got a 5-inch mortar set up, and we gave them hell one night with that.
Do you remember who your company commander was?
Captain Bailey, Major Bailey. Mm-hmm. And he was very confused all the time, seems to me. I know we came down, we were all called down off of Bennett's Hill the night of the before the surrender, you see. They had some Navy there, very small gunboats, and
torpedo boats and things like this, and they had been camouflaged, and they, some of them were docked in our Aberdeen Harbor. But the Japs came over and sunk them, and the Navy came up and joined us up on Bennett's Hill, and they brought some rum up with them. And so this was passed along the line. We were holding against the Japs, which were on the other side of the hill. And we all had a good slung of rum, and it was Christmas Eve, and we started to sing Christmas carols and waiting for something to happen. Lieutenant Nugent was the officer in command. And one section got into a bit of trouble on our left. Now, I don't know if it was Japanese that scared them off or what, but they started to run, you see. And somebody called them back. One of the boys got up and said, "What the hell's the matter with you yellow-bellied bastards? Get back up here in line and hold it." So they finally come back and said, "Well, I'll stay if Henderson does." And they all seemed to be enthused about my ability to lead them. Well, I says, "I'm right here, I'm staying. Keep those bullets low and don't let them come over the top. Somebody want to know if we should fix bayonets?" I says, "Hell no, don't let them get that close." And the Navy that were there, they were set up on the right, and they had some Lewis guns and things like this. But you could see the tracer bullets all flying away up in the air. And I hollered at them, "For Christ's sake, get them shots down." Now we just send a barrage every once in a while just to let the Japs know we were there and to keep the hell back. This was our waiting for daylight or dawn for a raid, you see. But we found out there was a machine gun nest set up just over top of this, but we couldn't reach it with hand grenades. We sneaked up a couple of times and threw some hand grenades, but we couldn't reach them. And we had sent out for a mortar. We didn't have a mortar with us, and we thought if we had this mortar, we would be able to knock out that machine gun nest, and then we could advance some more. And finally, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Christmas Day, this fella arrives up the hill bringing the mortar, but there was no ammunition. And the ammunition was still coming. And then the next fella that came up said that it was a capitulation, that we were all to turn in our arms and go down the hill again, back to Aberdeen Village. So, there was nothing else we could do. The order for capitulation had come earlier than this, it seems to me, but the Japs were still shooting at us.
So you couldn't.
So I said, "They're shooting at us, we're going to shoot back." But it was later on in the afternoon that we finally accepted and we went down the hill. And, they had soup and tea for us down there in one of the big buildings. And we all got together in our platoon, and a phone call had come through from Major Bailey that we were to gather up at his pillbox. So we all went up there and picked up what was left of our kit that we had in a storeroom up there and marched up to One Side Gap. Bailey was in a little car, and there was a fellow driving him, and he was carrying a big white flag, you see, at the head of the column. And we went up, and the Japanese sat us down on the side of the road. This was the following day, actually. It would be the 26th of December. The Japs sat in this crossroad at One Side Gap with machine guns on us, and there was nothing, and they searched us, you see, and they tore up our photographs and took our watches and anything that they thought was of value. And I put my wristwatch around my ankle, so they didn't find it. And I was carrying a big army clasp knife, and I thought for sure they would take that from me, but they didn't. I was quite surprised because it was a vicious weapon, and somebody stole it from me eventually and traded it off for some rice rations or something. But a friend of mine had come down from the hospital in a truck. He was in the motor transport department, and we used to work quite a bit together while we were in the Army. And he was half lit. And they had to get water up to the hospital. And this is what he had come down for. And he was most insistent that we make a run for it. Get into the truck. He says, I can back that bloody truck up as fast as it can go ahead. He says, we'll get the hell back to the hospital. But I had the worst time talking him out of it, because what was the sense of risking at that time? What could we do? You see, so I had quite a job to keep Cease from making the run for it, getting into this truck. I don't know, they marched us down into Kowloon City, and they hadn't given us anything to eat. We picked up what we could. I don't know, I remember getting about a half a dozen cans of carnation milk. Now, I hated this stuff. But I never had anything so delicious, it seemed to me afterwards, that as this carnation milk, drinking it out of the can. I was so hungry and so thirsty. This carnation milk was just like honey. It was good. And so, we got into a school of some sort, some boarding school which had been evacuated. We spent the night there, and there had been a bunch of motorcycles and things accumulated there, little British motorcycles. Well, before the war, I had a motorcycle, so I knew all about them. I got one started up and started riding around in the compound with the darn thing. I had a notion to take it out on the street because the streets were just bare. There wasn't a soul around. But I put the thing back, and the Japs didn't know anything about machinery, cars and things. They weren't familiar with them. They weren't able to make too much of this stuff operate. The fellas had taken the distributors apart on some of their cars and things like this so that they wouldn't be operable. But and one of the boys in my group, we sort of picked together, he picked up about 5 pounds of oatmeal somewhere. He put that in his pack, and somebody else got a hold of some salt, and somebody got bully beef and odds and ends of stuff. And so we cook up a meal, and about 6 of us would get around in one can. We had no dishes, and something for a spoon, and we'd eat up this mush that we had cooked up. And the Japanese didn't seem to move in the daytime, at night time they always see. And they got a bunch of us together, and we had to go down into this headquarters where we gathered up all the equipment that was there and took it to a warehouse where the Japanese could inspect it. There was revolvers, there was compasses, there was binoculars, there was all kinds of things. So I stuck a compass in my pocket, didn't turn it in, and I got a hold of a pair of binoculars, and I thought if there was ever a chance to escape, these would be good things, you see, to have. And I managed to keep them for a long time. The opportunity to escape never arrived. There was just no possibilities. In Jamaica, we had the experience of a couple of earthquakes. This was quite a thrill, actually, never having been in one before. It was just a tremor of the earth, but it was so amazing you didn't know what to do. The boys that were inside of the hut, they felt it. They run out of the hut. The boys that were out standing on the ground, they didn't know what the hell to do. They run into the hut for protection. You know, you just, what are you going to do with this thing? You're shaking. The other one was, we were up in Newcastle, and they had a church up there where they showed movie pictures. And all of a sudden, I thought the guy behind me was shaking my chair, and I turned around, what the hell are you doing? And then everybody was shaking. The whole place was shaking from this earthquake. But it didn't last very long, and there was no damage done. But it was just a So I was always hoping that Japan, Hong Kong, inside being a sort of an earthquake area, that there might be an earthquake or a tidal wave or a disruption of some sort where Chantfeather would have a chance to sneak away.
Yeah.
And his loss could be accounted for by some tragedy like that, but nothing ever occurred. It was four fellows did try to escape from North Point Camp. But they were caught. They got into a side bomb. They had very bad luck. It was a stormy night. But they got into this sandpan to get across to the mainland, and the thing leaked. And it sunk on them halfway over. And about 5 o'clock in the morning, I understand, the Japanese patrol boat picked them up out of the water. We never seen. We just heard horrible tales about them after that. And the Japanese treated us very cruelly after that. They called us all out. As soon as they were discovered, they called us out for a roll call. Sick men, everybody, had to get out, pouring rain, stand in line, be counted about 6 times. They weren't very good figures, and they'd be marching on the ground, adding up. And we didn't know how to count in Japanese at that time. They eventually taught us how to count in Japanese so that our roll calls would be easier for them. And anyway, they got through the whole camp, and then they took the man in charge, who would be a senior NCO, of each hut, of the hut that the man escaped from, and they put them in jail. They kind of held them responsible for the escape of these boys escaping. Nobody knew anything about it. They kept the real dark secret. Mm-hmm. And how they got over the fence, I don't know. It was electrically charged, and they had big police dogs. I remember one rainy day, one of the police dogs had got in under the fence, and its back rubbed against the high-tension wire, and down it went dead. It was electrified. This was in North Point Camp. Of course, I'm getting away ahead of my story because we still haven't got to a location. They were marching us around in Kowloon, and one night they crowded us all into a room. How we ever got in there, I don't know. There wasn't room to lay down or sit down, and you just were in there, packed in there, and that was it. And of course, in the morning, everybody had to go to the bathroom. So there was officers and everybody standing up along the line of building, urinating. And then they put us on parade and marched us. I guess they finally marched us through to North Point Camp because they got the refugees. It was originally a refugee camp, you see. And they chased the refugees out and put us in there. And they kept us in there for quite a few months. But they used to send work parties out across onto Kowloon on the mainland where they were enlarging the airport. And you're fortunate that you got on a work party. They would send different groups each day because you got some bread if you went on the work party. I'm a little confused on this. Because I remember in Sam Shapo, whether we went there first or not, I think we did, because we used to trade through the fence with the Chinese. Sam Shapo had been stripped clean. The Chinese had got in there and taken anything of any value. All of the biscuits, we called them, there was 3 pads that we laid out on an iron bedstead to make a bed mattress for our bed. We call them biscuits, and they had to be piled up in 3 at the head of our bed when we made our bed at night, in the daytime. And they had taken all this stuff for the material in it. They took the taps off, they took the wood off, they took everything that you could. The doors were missing, the windows were missing. They just cleaned it out completely. The water was running from every spout. There was no water pressure. Water was a shortage. But here it was running to waste, and there was nothing we could do about it. And it happened for a long time, but I remember seeing sampans out on the bay with sails made out of the yellow cloth of these biscuits. They had taken the time, tediously sewed together all these little squares to make a great big sail for their boat. And then, of course, the rations and stuff that they stole, they used to trade these back to us for our watches or anything of value that we might have, or money even. If we had money, they'd... But the Japs finally stopped all this. They chased them all away. And I remember one Chinese woman, she sent a little girl across the street to make a quick trade with somebody at the fence. And when she was running back, the Jap guard shot her right in the middle of the road. So there wasn't any more trading done. I think a lot of the Hong Kong volunteers managed to get out. They knew their way around Hong Kong, and they could hide, and they mixed with Chinese people, and nobody would know any different, you see? Because there were very few Hong Kong volunteers in our prison camp. There was Indian, there was English, and there was Canadians. And although most of the Indians were accepted by the Japanese as, and put to work as assistants and made steve guard duty and a lot of things like this. I know later on when we were on permanent parades, work parties going to the airport to work, we would see these Indian fellas standing guard. They used to make us go out, walk out to the airport, dig into the side of the mountain, and spread the dirt out across to build the airport up higher and make it wider. They had little mine cars on tracks, and we would fill these mine cars and push them out on the track and dump them and build up into a great big high, and we raised the level of this airport by digging into the side of the mountain to get filled. And then they got a whole bunch of cement. They had absolutely no idea of construction, but they got sand and cement on the ground, and we'd mix it in little piles with water, put it into a basket, carry it over, and dump it on the ground. No thickness to it or anything. It just lay there and crumpled, actually. It was ridiculous. It was just a waste of good cement. But we weren't going to interfere, of course. Let them do what they wanted. This is what they wanted, and this is what we did. And we were supposed to pave this big airport. It never got accomplished. They eventually got it done, I suppose, after we went to Japan. But while we were there, it was never completed.
And I guess there was a lot of deaths in that while you were in Shamshui Po. Like, there was a lot of people.
There was, yes. There was an epidemic broke out, diphtheria epidemic. Now, when a fellow died, we were in Shamshui Po first. They took us on the ferry and brought us over to Shamshui Po, and we were in there for a while, and there was no arrangements made for rations. And we had nothing to cook with. The boys that cooked, I remember, they dug a pit in the ground, put some iron bars across it, and built a fire in the pit, and put some gas drums on top of these bars, filled them with rice and water, and let them cook. And they cooked up. And if they had any vegetables, they just threw that in with it, made a big mush out of it. And twice a day, we got some of this mush that was cooked up. Officers, everybody just stood in line with a tin can, anything you could lay hands on for utensils. And we marched through this line, and the fellow that was dishing the grub out had to be very careful that everybody got exactly the same amount, or there was hell to pay, you see. You're favoring somebody, this was no good. Everybody had to be share and share alike. And I remember when you got through the line, you would run around and get back on the end again. In case there was some left over, you might get a second helping. A second helping would be about a half a scoop, you see. And the fellow that was dishing it out, he daren't give too big an issue, because if he runs short before everybody got some, he was in a bad spot. So they give us hot water every once in a while to drink in place of tea. Anybody that had tea could make tea, but this was a scarce commodity. Tea and coffee was just out of the question. But we lived on rice twice a day and hot water, and we just wandered around trying to pass the time. Our first days of captivity in Sham Shapo. I remember the fella dishing the rice out. He'd come to the bottom and couldn't get any more out. He'd just throw the scoop into them and jump the hell out of the road, and everybody would dive in and scrape out with their hands. We lived like animals. It was terrible that, you know, what hunger will do to you.
Did you have anything to do with the gardening that went on?
No.
They tried to build.
Yes, I did, but this was in Japan. I was, but no gardening done in Hong Kong while I was there. Mm-hmm. But in Japan, I was on a garden party. This was in 1945, after they moved us out of the shipyard.
Let's catch up to that. How did you get to Japan? Did you have a choice of staying in Shanghai?
Yes.
or going?
Depending on how sick you were. If you were able to walk across the road, you were entitled to go to Japan. And we all got needles and things like this. Well, I wanted to get the hell out there. I was happy to go to Japan. I thought, well, it can't be any worse. If I remember, Tugby, he had been picked on numerous occasions to go out on ration parties where they had to do some heavy work, lifting bundles of stuff onto trucks and bringing it into camp for rations. And when you were out on a ration party, you sometimes got the opportunity to get a little bit of bakshi ration, you know, if it was a broken bag of raisins or something you could pick up to eat. And so this was quite an opportunity. But when it come time for him to walk across the road, he couldn't make it. He didn't want to leave Hong Kong. Eventually, he did go to Hong Kong, or go to Japan on another draft, and he was shipped away up north. And he was in charge of the camp. The senior NCO who was there wasn't very well. He was a man he wasn't familiar with discipline, one way or another. And so Tugby took over, and he treated the boys terribly. And he was supposed to have been cooperating with the Japs. If the boys stole from the Japs, he would beat them up. And in our camp, if we stole from the Japs, this was to our advantage. You know, this was just accepted. It was what you can get, you can get. It was always just steal right and left, because we had to steal lunches, steal firewood, steal light bulbs and tape, all kinds of things. Anything you get your hands on, you steal, because the Japanese were very hard up for a lot of commodities, which we were sometimes able to get our hands on, so we could trade it for food. If I could get a roll of friction tape out of a warehouse, I'd put it in my pocket, and I'd take it out and trade it to some Japanese civilian, and he'd bring me something in place, you see? Something food, maybe some spice for my meals and things like this. A rice ball, which seemed to be very popular over there for their meals, white rice it was made of. And this is in Japan, of course, so we should get back perhaps to Hong Kong. In Hong Kong, we got $10 bill from Mackenzie King at Christmas time with a little card. This was Christmas of 1942. And there was supposed to be $10 in it. Well, the Japs kept the $10 and they gave us 10 yen. And they brought a canteen in where we were able to buy cigarettes at 10 cent a package, which was very reasonable. And there was eggs, which were a bit more expensive. There was small cans of jam, There was numerous items, but not enough to go around. Cigarettes would just disappear right away as soon as the place opened. Everybody would get in line and buy the cigarettes up. Then they would go in for the other rations that there might be there. And somebody got a bright idea of making electric heaters out of two tin cans, one little smaller than the other. And by putting bamboo insulating strips in around between the two cans, and then some electric wire, and connecting the one onto each can, you could put this into a pot of water, and plug it into electric lights, and it would heat that pot of water to boiling, you see? So we used to boil our eggs that way, and heat some of our rice dishes, and use it to whatever advantage we could. In cooking. I remember one time we had quite a big bucket, and I had made one of these electric heaters, and we had several cans that we were heating in this bucket of water, and it seemed to be taking such a long time that I was getting fed up with it, so I got a little bit of salt and I sprinkled it in the water. Well, this made it work twice as fast, but it used twice as much electricity and it blew the main fuse in the can. But we never got caught using these heaters. The Japanese interpreter who was there at the time, he was from Kamloops. He had gone to school, brought up in Kamloops, and he was about 16. He knew all our swear words and everything else, talked English like you or I. And he used to come around, most hideous little bastard. And when we were counting, he'd just over the head with his sword all the way down the line. 1, 2, 3, 4, you see, and numbered us off. But he used to come out at night, there'd be no lights on. We'd all be standing around in groups talking, and he'd come out there without his uniform on and listen into our conversations. So we had to watch what the hell we were saying and who was around, or we'd get into trouble. I can't think of his name right now. The Kamloops Kid, we called him. But we'd be marching to the airport on work party, and he'd, "Keep your eyes off those girls, you white bastards. You can only go home and pull your wires anyway," you know. As though we weren't capable of doing anything, but it was just if we saw some civilians on the street, it was kind of attractive. We saw many earlier in the time, we saw the Chinese that had been bedding down and bombed out buildings and broken buildings and things that had no place else to go. Some were dead, some were just hanging around. There were some of the Australians that were there. They had got together and attempted to build a radio. And they got hold of some radio parts, but they were short of condensers, and they tried to make some, but it wasn't really too successful. I don't know if they ever got the thing completed or not, but they were trying to build a radio so we could get some outside. And I heard that the only way to escape from Sham Shapur would be a mass escape, for the Chinese to be involved in it so that we could all go at once, because anybody who remained behind would suffer, you see. If somebody escaped, their policy was to cause those who remain to suffer. At that North Point, they cut off our medical supplies, they cut down our food rations, they did a whole lot of things after these boys escaped that made our life miserable for us. But, we took it all in good stead. And finally, they come around and released the leaders of the huts back into the camp. Hadn't done them any harm. They had just imprisoned them separately for some building for a while.
I heard that they took all the senior officers and sent them to another camp or took them away or something. Was that while you were in Sham Shapur?
In Sham Shapur, we finally got organized. The officers got together and they got their companies together under a sergeant major, and we got huts where each company got in their huts under a bit of military arrangement. But at first it was just a hodgepodge because they were bringing men in from everywhere, and everybody was mixed up. And there was no regulations or rules or anything laid down. And the food that came in, well, we went and got it the best way we could. They brought in a bunch of live pigs one time. We had quite a job, about a half a dozen live pigs, chasing them all over camp, catching them, killing them, cleaning them, getting them ready to cook them. I didn't have any part of this, but I remember the pigs coming in. And in the way of food. However, once they got organized, and our regiment sergeant major, he was appointed sergeant major of the camp. And he had to get a list of everybody in that camp. Now, this was so that we would have something to go on.
Remember who that was?
Paddy Keenan. RSM Paddy Keenan. He lives over not too far from here. And so he went around it. It was a bit of jealousy about this, he was telling me on the quiet. The other sergeant, the RSMs, felt that they should have had the job. He says, but he can just see our colonel, when they asked for a man, speaking up, I've got just the man for the job, you can have Paddy Keenan do this, you know. So anyway, he got stuck with the job to keep the record of all the prisoners in the camp. And so he got the other sergeant major's cooperation, and they took down the names and numbers of their particular battalions. And Paddy took down all the names and numbers of those in our battalion, and he kept the list of the whole camp of who was captured and how, what condition they were in, if they were wounded or sick in hospital or just how they were. And somehow or other, we managed to get a list of all the dead. And some who died in battle, some who were missing, some who were... Where this list come from, I don't know. I got a copy of a whole bunch of names that I had forgotten, actually, but fellas who died in hospital, fellas who were still in hospital, and... when the ration truck would go up to hospital, it would bring back rumors of various kinds and spread around the camp and raise our hopes. And so early in the war, somebody got a bright idea if we made up a pool. Everybody put in a date of when the war would be ended. And this was sometime perhaps in January. So we quarter a piece or 10 cents a piece when we got the money, you see. We would, so everybody put down their hopeful date, and it ranged from May, somebody had put in as early as May, until as late as September the 28th, I think. Or was it September the 31st, which there is no such date. However, this was our hopes. It was some crazy guy had taken the September date. He had been know what he was thinking about, the way we felt, you know, because we never looked that far ahead. We never accepted the fact we would be prisoners so long.
You were all in the same year, May to September in the same
year.
Yeah,
1943. However, this pool fell through, and the time went by, and pool was discarded. Another one was never arranged that I know of with our group. However, Christmas came and we got our $10 from the Kennedy King, and we got some extra rations and some clothing from the African Red Cross, I believe it was. With some extra rations to come in, which were divvied up for a Christmas dinner, and we had a bit of a Christmas celebration, and one of the boys, he was quite a good singer, he sang some Christmas songs, and then after Christmas, this would be in January, I guess they called for men to go over to Japan on work parties. And they lined us all up on one side of the road, boxes across the road one by one, and if you were able to make it, you were able to go on. I had a skin diphtheria, they called it. Oh, I was going to tell you about the diphtheria epidemic. They used to blow the bugle in the last post whenever somebody died, see? And they'd bring in a coffin and take him out the gate. But when the diphtheria epidemic broke out, there were so many dying east side that they quit blowing the bugle. hospital facilities were very poor, and they had no way of treating any sicknesses or anything. And they were just sneaking these dead out so not to affect the morale of the camp. And then the Japs came around and started taking swabs to find out who were the diphtheria carriers. And they sorted us all out, and I was one of the carriers. I didn't take diphtheria, but as a diphtheria carrier. And I had broken out in a lot of scabs and sores on my legs. Tropical ulcers, they call them. And we had nothing to treat them with. However, they put us all into a confined area, barbed wire around it, and we were stuck over there in these huts and forgotten about it. We were lucky to get arrested. And I couldn't move. My legs were so bad that I couldn't. I had laid in bed all day. And they never had a bowel movement for ages, I don't know. But somebody would go over to the fence, pick up our rations and our hot water, which was cold by this time, would be carried over by the cookhouse and set over the fence. They'd rush, you see. And then some of these fellows that were acting as orderlies would come and bring this food around to us, and so we did get our food. But I remember lying in bed, and there was a shower room just down the way from me, and this doggone water running constantly. It just sounded like steak frying to me. It was torture. But these orderlies had decided that they were going to do something for me.
Were they Japanese?
They were English, British. And they thought they would pull these scabs off of my legs, which would let them heal. So they got me out of the bed and took me into a little screened-in room with a table in it, and they laid me out on this table. I was stripped bare naked. I was dreading this terribly because it looked very painful. And darned if the flying tigers didn't come over and started bombing Hong Kong. Well, these are orderlies. They forgot everything. Away they went. See what the bombing was about. Everybody was free choice. It was just tremendous pickup for the camp. And it let me go scot-free without my peeling out of damn scars, because I had attempts to take them off myself, and I couldn't bear it. It was just unbearable. Mm-hmm. And so I got away with that. They finally came back. It was too late to do anything, so they took me back to my bed again. But there was a British doctor, Dr. Ashton Rowe, who had served quite a bit of time in India. And he was a very capable man, and a humorous sort of man. He had a nice bedside manner, didn't he? And he got us out of these huts into another place which he had as a hospital. And the only things about that they had for medicine was sulfanilamide, which they used for the treatment of gonorrhea, and pot tomang, which was also. That was one of the worst gonorrhea spots in the world, was Hong Kong, so they had a tremendous supply of this brandy. And it was in our Red Cross rations, there was what they called ghee oil, which was butter made from goat's milk, which the Indians ate. They wouldn't eat the butter from cows, you see, this was against their religion. However, Ashton Rose got a can of this ghee oil. And he mixed up an ointment of sulfanilamide pills crushed and ghee oil, and he treated my ulcers with this. which was very satisfactory. It healed them up. And I remember them coming around each day in the hospital with a wisecrack for everybody. You know, we at least look forward to him coming in. We're going to have, a guy would be down to 78 pounds, you know, just nothing. You've got to race with so-and-so today. Now, you're getting into shape for it. You know, he'd come in with some wisecrack about how you had to get up and get around. So he asked me how long I had been in bed, you see. He said, well, you've got to get up out of there. You can't stay there forever. He said, I want you up bed and walk around it twice a day, you know, and keep exercising myself until I finally got back on my feet again. And then he asked me, when was the last time I had gone to the bathroom? I says, 21 days. Oh, my gosh, he says, call out the engineers. Get some cool chisels and hammers. So then he says, give that man an enema. And so I got an enema that day. And by gosh, I never had such a movement in my life before. I just filled that pot. Just so, finally the diphtheria epidemic came to an end, and we were all let out. Later, when I got to San Francisco, the doctors were quite interested in these scars from my legs and the history of them. You see, they took photographs of them, and there was another one reoccurring, a smaller one, and they were quite interested in that. But they called it skin diphtheria. This was their diagnosis. So this is probably what, without me being a carrier, I didn't get a diphtheria, but I had this other side effect.
A break, and I'll turn this tape over with you. Just about them. Recount a few incidents like that, like the Rice Oak program.
I don't know who the organizer was. We had an officer with us who was connected with the YMCA in charge of sports and things like this, you see, and entertainment. And I believe he would be the instigator of this and made the arrangements to have the boys volunteer to put on some sort of a skit. More musical, sing, dance, anything at all that would be entertaining and break our monotony. And there wasn't too many of these things occurred in Hong Kong while I was there, the year I was there, maybe two. We had our Christmas party, which was very good, and everybody was in high spirits and said, next year we'll be at home. We'll be enjoying turkey and mince pie. This went on every Christmas we were there, that we wouldn't be here for another Christmas. We would be home. This was as far ahead as we looked. As I said, we, in North Point, we attempted some study groups. We got together and tried to learn French and political science and anything that they could dig up that might be of some interest to the boys. I remember taking notes and trying to brush up on my French, and it's all gone now, but I did attempt it. I had taken some French at school very reluctantly, and I didn't do very well in it. Excuse me.
Okay, when you were in Hong Kong, you were working in Japan. You worked in electrical one.
Yeah, we had this test of getting being medically fit to go to Japan. Mm-hmm. So after we were able to walk across the road, we were gathered into a group of, and they selected 500 of us and gave us a lot of needles and stool tests and things like this to see that we weren't carrying any communicable diseases and stuff. And they loaded us onto a Red Cross ship
And we were stuck down in the hold of this Red Cross ship with all the lights on and big red crosses on it and everything. But we were jammed down in the hold. There was barely room to lay down. And bathroom facilities were horrible. You had to, everybody had to use the same one. And you had to step over everybody to get to the darn latrine. And it was terribly awkward. I forget how we were fed. We were about 3 days, I guess, in the crossing. Mm-hmm. And the Japanese had been writing up in articles in 1942 in a paper I read where the Americans had so cleverly torpedoed a hospital, a Japanese hospital ship. You know, this was some propaganda they had put out. And so I was a little bit concerned that there might be American submarines in there, but I didn't think that they would torpedo a hospital ship. We arrived in Hong Kong, in Japan, and they took us by train in up to Yokohama, where we were marched into this prison camp, which consisted of two huts. There was 250 men to a hut. And just as we walked in line, one behind the other, we were numbered. And from that time on, it was Royal Rifles and Grenadiers and everybody mixed up together, Postal Corps, Headquarter Company, and Medical, everybody and anybody was just mixed up in a long single line, and we were given, my number come to 380. And so we were taken, we took bed number 380, and we were divided up then into groups of 50, with the senior NCO being in charge of that group, and we slept in beds which were benches of about 20 feet long, divided into seven spots with a rice straw carpet on it, and there were slats to divide off your bed space, and there was a shelf up above where you could put your belongings. We stayed in these huts for perhaps a year, but while we were there, they got busy and built another hut, which was higher, and it was new. Now, why they changed this over, I have no idea. But when we first arrived there, of course, we filled out papers telling what we wanted to do and what sort of job we thought we would like, and they gave us a choice of a whole list of jobs that were available. And so I was put into the electrical group. There was 10 of us in that. And we wore a jacket with EL on it. And our number was 1010 was my number. Juban, which is number 10 in Japanese, was what they called me. You see, my number was 10. And so we got out to the shipyard, and the Jap who was our boss was a very fine fellow. Sato was his name, and he was the electrician, and he got us all together, and he asked us some questions about electricity, couldn't speak English, but he wrote formulas out on the paper, voltage, amperage, and ohms, and how they were involved, and we understood, you see. So he was quite satisfied. So he gave us a job assembling a bunch of sockets into a box where they were using for something or other. So we sat around making up these boxes. And then they took us over to what they called the electrical shop. Now, there was two of the boys in our group. They were very fortunate. Well, whether it was fortunate or not, I don't know, but they got a job inside of the shop, working at a bench. One was with the Signal Corps, I believe, and the other was a fisherman, but from New Brunswick. Anyway, George Grant, he got very good at the Japanese language, and he could talk very well. So that he could discuss things and then tell us about it. The remainder of us, there was eight of us, if there was nobody safe, we went around gathering supplies from the various warehouses bringing them back to the electrical shop where they were assembled and ready to go on the ship. And these warehouses were very sacred places. The Japanese were not allowed in there, excepting those that worked there.
Mm-hmm.
But we as prisoners could come and go practically as we liked, because they were afraid the Japanese would steal something.
But they didn't realize that we were stealing something.
And another advantage to it was cigarette paper. It was very scarce, something that would be suitable for rolling cigarettes. We tried toilet paper, we tried leaves out of our Bibles, we tried any number of things. However, there was a paper which they used to bail coils of wire with in these electric warehouses. So when we were in there, I would get busy and unroll as much as I could of this paper that they bailed the wire in. I'd shove it in my pocket and take it back and sell it in camp for cigarettes. You see, so much paper, I'd get a cigarette for it.
Yeah.
Well, the boys were happy to do this because cigarettes were scarce, but we used to pick up butts. It was our only tobacco supply. So we needed paper to roll these butts up in.
And
the Japanese were very short of tobacco themselves. And it was pretty hard to come by. we spent the summer doing various chores, digging ditches for electrical wire, and hauling a two-wheeled cart, which we went around and picked up supplies, electrical boxes and switches and wire and cables, and taking it back. And our boss at that time was a retarded Jap. Didn't have a lot of senses. Takahashi, we called him, and we could get away with murder. Well, Tak, what are we going to do today, you see? And we'd sit down and have a cup of tea, boil up. We had a secret spot where we would gather, and we got along fine with Takahashi. They'd come and tell him, the Jap tell him that we had to go somewhere yet, so he would take us and get this stuff and bring it back, but he wasn't a capable person in any way. And so we were utterly spoiled. We could go scrounging for cigarette butts and things like this, and he wouldn't miss us, you know.
Yeah.
But later on in the course, things were getting tough, I guess, for the Japs, and they brought in a bunch of students from Kobe, Japanese students. And they were very enthusiastic. And they were going to take over and shipyard and do as they were patriotically taught to do. And one of them was put in charge of our group. Well, it was an incident where I thought we should have our cup of tea as usual in the morning. And I started to make the tea. And he told me to stop. I didn't pay any attention to him, see? So we all agreed we were going to have our tea, so we made up this tea and had our cup of tea, and then we went back to work. Well, at noon, their form of disciplinary is, of course, I suppose, we all lined up in the shop, and ready to march back to the lunchroom for our lunch, and he called me to step out in front of the line. So I stepped out, and he slapped me across the face a couple of times like this and told me to step back. In the meantime, one of the boys that wasn't aware of all this is Bill Fisherman down east. I can't think of his last name at the moment. He said that he hit Alec, and he stepped out and hit the guy in the jaw, knocked him to the floor, caused a great destruction in the shop. So George Grant, he had to do the talking for us. He was quite fluent in Japanese. And so there was everybody in the shop stopped, you know, let's see, we got in line, we marched off to the lunchroom. So George was talking all the way to this Japanese kid, telling him, now, don't say any trouble. He said, if you stir up trouble with the army, you're going to get in bad. Everybody was scared of the army. Civilians were different, but the army had official rule, and if the army investigated this, it could be a lot of trouble. But what I didn't know, both George and Bill had scored some sake that morning from Japanese. You see, they had got into a deal, and they had been drinking sake. So George was, or Bill was a little bit cut on sake. And George was worried in case the army investigated and got word of this deal in the sake, too. So it was a double problem. And anyway, the student agreed that he wouldn't say any more. And we got to lunch, and he dismissed us, we went into lunch, and he went away to get his. Well, that day passed, and at 4:30 we were sitting around, ready to be marched back to the lunchroom to go back home again, when all of the students that worked in the lecture shop, and there must have been about 60 of them, and there was one that weighed 250 pounds, a karate expert, I suppose, and he was leading them, and they were really going to give it to us. They come around the corner, and we were all sitting around, didn't know what the hell to do. We were looking for sticks or something to defend ourselves. There was just nothing around to throw. We really thought we were in for it. But this Japanese student, he got up and he talked to the leader, and he talked his head off. And he finally quietened them all down. And they went away quite satisfied. We went back. Felt very fortunate that we weren't massacred.
Did they treat you like, were the Japanese, for as much as they could, did they treat you well, or did they treat you badly?
Well, most of them are good-hearted. Although they used to brag about their tremendous abilities and capabilities and how they took a great pleasure in telling us that Canada was being rationed on sugar. So I told them, well, this didn't matter about sugar because Canada had lots of honey. We had plenty of bees and lots of honey, and so that this wasn't a problem. I just made this up, but I, you know, brushed it off that because they thought that we would be depressed by telling us that Canada was being rationed on sugar. There was some miserable Japanese. I know I had a bunch of cigarette butts that were wet, and I laid them out on a board to dry. And this one little Jap, he saw them. He got up, he stood on top of them, climbed up, pretending to climb up, and squashed all my butt. He did this intensely, you know. He was a miserable sort, and he was miserable to any chance he got. But most of them were quite interested in us as Canadians. Americans they hated. They couldn't tolerate Americans, but their propaganda was written up in such a way that Americans were criminals and hoodlums and no good nothing. As a matter of fact, in some of these papers it mentions how the Americans were talking to going to war against the Japanese who were doing so much good in the world, because of the attack on Pearl Harbor. And it was their domination that wanted to, you know, that these Americans were falsely led into the war under undue circumstances. This was propaganda that was in the papers.
We should jump ahead now to where the Allied forces came to Japan. I'm interested to know who were the first people you saw of the Allied forces.
Yeah, this is very interesting. Well, about the end of 44, there was an airplane flying overhead. It was very interesting to us. It was so high, and there was four vapor streams coming from it. And we couldn't imagine Japanese having four engine aircraft. And so we had to assume that it was an American. And I don't know if this was around November or sometime. However, later on there was more American aircraft come over. They had come over and taken a bunch of pictures, I suppose, gone back to Guam, and they set up, of course, for targets to bomb. So there was bombers came over. And occasionally there'd be an air raid siren go, and we would all have to run to the lunchroom and hide under the tables. Because of the bombing. I remember seeing one
the Japanese were bragging how, well, when the Americans go back out to sea, the Japanese fighters go out and chase them down, shoot them down over the sea so they wouldn't disrupt the mainland, see? But I said, this isn't true, I said, because I saw one American plane flying and a Japanese fighter going up to meet him, and he was hit and come crashing down. You had a story where the Japanese were very clever and they were able to land their small fighters on top of the B-39s and shoot the pilot in the cockpit because they had no protection from the top, apparently, see? And this was their propaganda that they were dishing out. However, these bombing attacks became more frequent, and they finally had us dig a trench outside of our hut, which was supposed to serve as an air raid shelter. And it was useless accommodation and insufficient. There wasn't room for everybody. And they had dug a couple and put some boards over and covered it with dirt. And anyway, I don't know what date it was, but this particular night there was a tremendous air raid. All those planes just come and came and came, and the Japs were throwing everything they had at it. There was AK-AK rifles and everything were going up. I saw 11 planes shot down, which was very disheartening. But they come wave after wave from about 11 o'clock at night to 5 o'clock in the morning. But the Japanese had got concerned about their supply of rations in the storehouse, you see, so they thought they'd better carry them out of the storehouse into one of the dugouts to protect them from fire. And so they got a bunch of us to volunteer to carry rice bags. So our purpose in carrying these rice bags was that we could get our hand in, get a handful of rice, and eat it while we were carrying the rice bag out to it. Two men would load this bag on your back and you'd stagger out to the pit and store the rice. And this I read on at this until I got too tired. And I thought, there's no use trying to crawl into that air raid shelter, which was jammed full of guys who couldn't stand up or sit down or anything else, very uncomfortable. So I thought, if there's a bomb comes, it's going to come, no matter where you are, you'll get it. And so I snuck into the hut, lay down to one of the beds closest to the door, and had a sleep. When the all clear came, I woke up, and the rest of the boys had been filing in. And by gosh, if at the foot of my bed, on the table, there was a bullet hole mark, the shape of a flat of a bullet. And I pointed to it, and one of the boys reached under the table and he picked up a slug out of an American aircraft. Yes, you could see the hole in the roof. It had come through. It had been a spent shell, I guess, spinning or something, and it had gone through the table and landed right at the foot of my bed. So, or the bed I was sleeping in. It wasn't actually my bed, but when the Japs come around later to check us all that we were there in our positions, this fellow showed the Jap the bullet. Well, the Jap kept it. I thought we should keep it as a souvenir, but the Jap hung onto it. So the shipyard was badly bombed, and I don't think we went to work for a couple of weeks. But they were making preparations to move us. And so we started trading off all our articles. We thought we were going to a Red Cross camp to be fattened up before we were sent home. And we had great expectations of something fine happening to us. I traded off a razor I had bought through the canteen, a straight razor, which I wasn't very capable of using, but I did get a shave with it. I traded to a Jap for 3 pounds of salt, which I stole, and I got as much tea as I could get a hold of because I didn't know when we might get some more tea. And tea was a very essential thing in our way of life. Mm-hmm. We just drank tea no end. I still do. Whether it's because of this, I don't know, but we drank bottles of tea. We used to heat bottles of water at the shipyard in the forges, you see, and wrap them up in warm wrappings and cart them home because hot water was at a premium in camp. It was one bucket of hot water came out to do a section, and it was too cold to make tea out by the time we got it. So this business of bringing hot water from the shipyard was quite a benefit. And anyway, they gathered us all together, they loaded us on the train and took us away up north to Sendai. And we got in, going in through the mountains, and we could see guys wearing helmets and miner's lamps and carrying lunch pails. And they got us into this camp, and there was a bunch of Javanese Dutchmen and English troops in there, and they were in terrible low spirits. They'd been working in this coal mine, and when we arrived, of course, they put us all out on the freight square. We took everything we had completely off, put all our kits down, our clothes on, and they gave us a G-string and some Japanese clothes to wear. And in the meantime, they searched every bit of our baggage. And they got my binoculars, which I had mentioned earlier, I still kept. The compass, I don't know. I think I hung on to it. But they got a hold of my Hello?
Oh, excuse me. Sure.
One of the boys had a pair of binoculars, but he was wiser than I was. He had taken his all apart, and the lenses he had hidden in his sewing kit, and other parts he had hidden somewhere else, and so they only found the skeleton of his binoculars, so they didn't get them. And I was worried that they might take my key and my saw and come the other side. This was what was concerning me more than anything else. But what I got into trouble for was a bullet for a Japanese gun, which I had picked up as a souvenir, and I had that in my kit. Now, it was about a 25, it was a little bigger than a 22, mm-hmm. and quite a bit smaller than the 303, which we used. And I thought this would be a bit of a souvenir to have Japanese bullets, so I kept this. So anyway, they wanted to know who owned this pack, and I caught hell over having this Japanese bullet. What was I going to do with it? You know, it, I don't know, it passed off somehow. And we got all our kit back again, and I managed to get my tea and salt and stuff, so I was quite happy. And we got into huts which were full of fleas. Fleas were a horrible thing over here. You just couldn't get rid of them. They used to keep you awake at night, so we had nothing to fight them with. It was quite a problem. We would go to bed at night, put on our pajamas. They gave us Japanese pajamas, which tied at the legs and the waist. And the fleas would get from your blankets in under your pajamas and eat the hell out of you. And they moved so fast, you could never catch them. So out we would go to the lavatory. There was one place where there would be light burning. Take off our underwear or our sleeping clothes, turn inside out, and pick all the fleas or chase them out, you see? Put them back on as quickly as you could, run back to your bed, and try to get to sleep before another attack of fleas would come and chew you up. I was reading in my diary some of the problems that we had. I had forgotten about this flea situation. However, we managed to live with them, and life in the coal yard was horrible. We had three shifts. One went down at 8 o'clock in the morning, and come off at 4. One would went forward, come off at 12. One would come off around at 12 and come off at 8. And it was going around the clock. And there was two surfaces. There was the 500 meter surface, which was the rock face, they called it, which wasn't so hot, you know, they worked on rock, the temperature wasn't too hot. But there was a 1,000 meter level where they mined the coal, and this was terribly hot. All we wore down there was a G-string, a baseball cap with a clip on it to put our mine lamp on, and a leather belt around our waist with a battery hanging on our hip, which wore the skin away, and a pair of running shoes. And we would go in there and blast and shovel coal, and we were supposed to get out 15 cars of coal a night. each group. And if we got out 18, they would give us some little presento. They'd give us an extra ration, which amounted to money cast, which was the, they called it. A residue from the soybeans, which was like cornflakes, I don't know. There wasn't too much to it. It wasn't worth working for. And you had a terrible time being sick enough. We had our own doctor with us. Dr. Reed came to our camp in the coal mine. And there was a Japanese doctor there too, but any of the boys that reported sick had to go through the Jap doctor, you see, and he was pretty strict, and you had to be pretty sick before you were allowed not to go down in the coal mine. And anybody that was capable of power put on garden party where they had to go out and work in the gardens, which was way up on the mountain above the coal mine. And one of the main jobs was emptying the latrines into wooden buckets, which we carried on a pole between two men, and we'd carry this up into the mountains and use it for fertilizer for the garden. But we were very short of fuel in the camp, and we were short of fuel for the cook stoves. We were also short of fuel for the bathhouse. So what we would do, coming back down past the coal mine, if there's nobody around, we would put coal into these buckets, cart it back to camp, and use it for extra fuel. So we used every sneaky way we could to attain benefits for ourselves. Eventually, we got through with the coal mine. It was a great day. Word come through, I was on night shift. Well, the atomic bomb had landed, and they didn't know what it was. And so, they shut off, whenever there was an air raid, they shut off the power all over the island. Shut everything down, all the generating stations. Everything was in darkness. And here we were up, ready to go down into the mine. Well, we couldn't go down because the electrically operated train wasn't working. So we had to walk down 500 meters to the lamp house where we got lamps to put on. Then we had to walk down to the 1,000 meter level where we had to disconnect electric motors from the pumps and take them up so they would be up above the water level that was gathering while the power was out, see? And coming up that night, that morning, we met the day shift going down, see? And they were all lined up inside the tunnel. No, they had us lined up inside the tunnel, which was a slimy, miserable, horrible place. You couldn't stand up or sit down because it was on a slope, and the walls were all wet and slimy. You could barely lean against them. And they kept us there. They had fixed bayonets on their rifles. And they kept us in there until they got an all clear or something on the air raid. No, they didn't have any sirens running because word went around that the sirens wouldn't blow a game until the Americans landed on the island. So anyway, they got the signal for all clear, and we went out, and the day shift would come on to work, and our first question, what's the weather like? Is there any rumors? And what's for breakfast? You see, we would ask the boys coming on. So off we went. We got back to camp, and prior to this, we had to go up into the bush and cut down a bunch of brush and cover the roofs of our huts for camouflage, you see. Mm-hmm. But the darn stuff all dried out in the day or two, and it just showed up worse than ever. However, this was their attempt to camouflage these huts. But on the morning of the end of the war, I was busy trying to go to sleep when the fleas were biting me so bad. I just tossing and turning, and I couldn't sleep. And I guess it was about 11 o'clock. And Sergeant McCauley, he went around in a great big voice around the camp, bellowing, "Night shift, get up! Day shift, or afternoon set, eat your bentos. Our bentos was our lunch. It was rice, which we carried in a little box, and maybe some vegetable. And night shift, go up to the kitchen and collect your rations. And so we were to eat the lunch, which was supposed to be up for the afternoon shift. The afternoon shift were to eat the bento, it was for supper, their supper in the mine. And the day shift was the last shift that worked in the mine. We never went back down the mine again after that. And word had gone around that the Japanese had capitulated, and so we thought, well, if the war is over, let's get out of here. The army guard disappeared, and some of us wanted to get a hold of our old Japanese bosses to beat the hell out of them, but we weren't able to find them. Our officers set up an MP system where we had our own boys on guard at the gate, and we wanted rations. We wanted food. So more food was brought into us. Finally, Dr. Reed, he was taken on a trip up to some large city close to there into a hotel where he had a meeting with the Japanese. And he came back and reported the effect of this meeting and told us the fleas were just as bad in the hotel as they were in the camp, and so there wasn't anything we could do about it. But our first supply and contact with the American world was some fighter bombers which came off of an aircraft carrier, and they flew down over our camp, opened their bomb bays, and dumped bread out. It rolled from one end of the compound, they were wrapped in sheets, all the way to the other end, with a bunch of us half-naked savages chasing after it, and just excited as could be. We could see the Americans waving at us out of the planes. Anyway, this was our first contact, and from then on, some planes come over and drop us supplies, clothing, Red Cross food, and information. And some magazines came down, newspapers, papers that the ship printed for distribution on the ship, you know, and things like this, which sort of brought us up to date. And of course, when these planes dropped the supplies, there were meat 29s that come up, or Sanju crew 39, come over, and they dropped oil drums full of canned food on parachutes, you see, and they would come floating down all around the country, and we would go out and gather them up and bring them back to the camp, and our rations were great to supplement it. And we had the American ration, boxes of American rations, which were delicious to us. The Americans would get up with it. Of course, they couldn't stand it. So, but it was their food supply. And we got one per man, which was wonderful. We had a great supper. And there was also some louse powder in there. We thought, what the hell is in this lice powder for? We haven't got any lice, you see. But we got the idea that, well, we'll try it. We sprinkled it on our beds, and by gosh, we didn't get the fleas. It was this new pesticide that had come out since we had been in war, which killed all types of insects. And so we were very elated then to find out that the lice powder worked very well. And the boys got out of camp. We went down to the little village post. We could go out and for an American chocolate bar, you could get a Japanese kid's bicycle for the whole day. You know, where they would be at the gates trading with us. And people in the village were most anxious to trade with us for our clothes or anything. The Japanese or the Americans had brought us some clothing. Army clothes and things like this, boots and stuff. And I remember buying a straw hat and a pair of suspenders and taking a piece of nylon parachute and wrapping around the neck for a scarf and dressing myself up and go down and have my picture taken. Matter of fact, I got a picture of three of us who had been in, and we traded him a bunch of old clothes that we had gathered up for taking our photos, you see. And money, we did have, we could get most anything, 300 yen for an old jacket or something, you know. Money is just no value to them at all. And then we would go and spend the money, and it was sometime that we went through this period waiting for our connection with the Japanese to be taken out of there, you see. It would take some time for them to get organized in Yokohama. And we, some of the boys from another camp about 10 miles away got out of camp, walked all the way over to our camp to visit us and tell us how things were going over there. And their camp was quite visible from the air, apparently, and they had more supplies than they could handle, and they didn't want any more. And one of the fellows had got up on the roof of the hut. He was a signaler, and he had a mirror, and he was trying to signal to the aircraft not to drop any more supplies, but they were overloaded. And damned if there wasn't a great big platform, which was set in the bomb bay to carry the barrels and things, and this was all released at once, you see, and then the parachutes would open, and this made out of 4x4s and 2x4s, this big platform was coming down on a parachute, swinging like this, knocked the kid off of the roof and killed him. And there was some other sad occurrences where aircraft crashed into mountains. They had come down too low, actually, to drop the supplies. Some of our first supplies come without parachutes. And they just sink belly deep in the paddy fields, and we would have to open them up and take all the stuff out.
Morale must have been at a lot higher point.
Oh, it really picked up. And now, who was the Queen of Holland? Julianne, I believe it was. It was her birthday on the 2nd of September, I think. And these Japanese troops, these Dutch, they all got out the best of their uniforms. They thought there was colored parachutes that dropped that day, and they thought this was then in response to Julianne's birthday, you see. And they had put on a big parade, and they celebrated the birthday of their queen. And to us, it was just another day of going out gathering rations, and we ate like pigs after that. We'd go down to the village and get chickens. Some of the boys would go and get rabbits from the farms and bring them in. It was like a hobo jungle. Everybody had a little fire going and cooking up something or other. And finally word come that we were to get on the, pack all our kit, get on one of these coal trains, that they were going to take us to the station. And we waited there. While we were waiting there, there was a Japanese officer come along with a pair of binoculars hanging around his neck. He walked down to the far end of the platform, and one of our boys walked after him, took the binoculars off of his neck, and put them around his own neck and come back and joined the cot. We got onto the train, and there was some other prisoners of war had been picked up earlier on the same train, and they took us to Yokohama. Well, at Yokohama, we were met by an American band and a bunch of celebrities, and we all got off the train onto buses, and the band was playing Old Canada and Stars and Stripes and all kinds of military music, and they took us down to a warehouse down on the waterfront. We went in at the back end, we stripped off all our clothes, and we gave our name and number and a few things, and stripped off all our clothes, had a shower, we were given fresh clothes to put on, sprayed with DDT and some other insecticides, and put on fresh clothes, and then we went and picked out a telegram that we wanted to send home. Now we could pick out a number. There was five choices of whichever message we chose. You see, all they had to do was send number five, which was a message for Alec Henderson, and to his parents. I gave him the address in Canada. And this telegram then, of course, was forwarded to my parents till I was safely repatriated. Then, from there, we were given a bit of a medical, and we went through a chow line and picked up all the grub we wanted and sat down at tables and ate it. And
eventually we got sorted out and put on to different ships for sleeping accommodation. We got onto some sort of a landing boat with carried vehicles and was cot set up on the deck instead of vehicles. There was a whole lot of cots set up and we slept there overnight. Well, next morning, they had no accommodation for food, you see. Next morning, we had motorboats running all over the harbor as sort of taxis. And we got loaded into these motorboats and taken over to the warship Ohio. No, Idaho. And well, we were given the grandest welcome. Everybody was handing us everything. We got chocolate bars, cartons of cigarettes, everything we wanted. Well, then we went down for breakfast. We lined up, got two eggs, toast, bacon, coffee. One of the American officers, he stepped out on the floor and said, "These men are hungry. Give them something to eat. Anything they want." So the cooks got mad, and they made eggs and bacon and food, and so much that we could just scarcely get it down.
And did you come back from there? Did you leave on that warship?
No. No, we stayed aboard that ship, and we were given a buddy, one of the sailors. Mm-hmm. And the particular one that our group got, him and his brother got together, put some money into a fund, and gave it to us. And we said, "What do we need money for? We can't buy anything. Everything's still good." "Oh, he's sweet here, Richard. He's on fire, so we got this money from him." And then they put a picture show on deck that night. And I was up watching the picture show. And one of the boys comes and sat down beside me and he says, "Are you going to fly home?" I says, "Fly home? How?" "Well," he says, "they're calling for volunteers to fly home." I says, "Aren't you going?" He says, "No." I says, "I've taken that first because it is. The hell with that." So I hightailed it down. He says, "If you want to fly, go down to the MO lounge." So I came down there and I was the last in line. I finally got into the MO and checked my heart and my condition and the effectiveness capable of flying. So we were all, next day we were all taken up to the airport on buses. There was three plane loads of us, 94 men on a plane. And we flew from there to Guam. In Guam, we met up with a bunch of other boys that we hadn't seen for years from other prison camps, and we had a grand time there. And it was very odd. They had a Red Cross Center. Everything was free. And these girls in there, which we hadn't seen for years, we would pick up a donut very gingerly, you know. No problem, it was for free. We have as many as you want. Well, terrific. Chocolate bars, cigarettes, coffee. Anyway, after we visited that, next day we went into the mess hall and we were given all the rations we could eat and all the meals we just fed us no end, double rations. And I put on a pound a day. We were about a week in Guam. They drove us around on tours to different airports explaining the workings of, it had these here small Piper Cubs which flew around for reconnaissance, for aircraft, for artillery, and they had the big bombers and the fighter planes and the transport planes, and they had all these different airfields which they had set up in Guam. And we could see from our camp a swamp down in the valley, which looked like a little village. And we were quite wondering what it was. While we were on our tour, we went down through this area. And here it was stockpiles of war supplies in great big crates.
piled up two stories high, you know. It was a tremendous supply of material. It was sort of laid out in avenues and blocks and squares so that they could get at it too. They gave us a ticket for free beer. Everybody was entitled to two cans of beer, you see, the American Army. So we got our beer tickets, we saved them very hopefully that it's wonderful. We hadn't had beer for so long. So we go up where they're dishing out the beer and hand in our tickets and get our two cans of beer. The damn stuff's warm. It's American beer, which is only 2%, and it tasted like hogwash. The one biggest disappointment that we had, I think, while we were there, it was. However, from there, they gave us medicals. And they checked us, they found some of the boys had TB. I thought I had TB because I had been coughing horribly for the last year I was in camp. This terrible cough, and I just couldn't get rid of it. But I got through. I was most surprised when they gave me a clear slate. And from there they flew us by way of Wake Island. We stopped at Wake Island in these troop transports. And they were bunks. We sat four on a bunk, all down the side. We landed in Wake Island about 9 o'clock. We'd come through some turbulence, which gave me a headache and a bit of a sick feeling. And we come down through this turbulence, and we landed in Wake Island, and we got off there, and I went into the Red Cross, and I got some aspirin for my headache, which helps a lot. And then they took us into the mess hall and gave us a great big feed. And we had crossed the international dateline, I think, so it was the 18th of September, which we had twice. Mm-hmm. We lived the 18th of September, and we crossed the international dateline into the 18th of September and landed in Hawaii. Well, they were very gracious in Hawaii and told us that stateside clothing was very scarce to hang on to everything we got, and they issued us a bunch more clothing. So we had uniforms from the CBs, from the artillery. We had a great mixture of clothing. We had underwear, we had shoes, we had just supplied with everything. And they gave us kit bags, and we just loaded them like full and brought them home with us. The clothes we wore, nobody knew what we belonged to because we had a mixture of different uniforms.
You went from there to San Francisco.
And then they finally got us sorted out. We lived in the hospital in Hawaii for 2-3 days. And they were just good to us. They opened the kitchen the whole day long. We could go in and get ice cream and anything we wanted. And they had a bit of a kitchen on the ward where the nurses were only too happy to make us something to eat and talk about our adventures and tell us of what was going on the outside. This was our first, when we got onto the battleship, the boys told us about the zombies and the different things that were going on, how things were going, the different football games and the movie stars and the shows that were on, and brought us up to date on a whole lot, told us about radar and a whole lot of things that hadn't come into effect since we were taken in. And so from Hawaii, it was about a half a dozen of us, I guess, or 8 or 10 of us, flew out on one of these amphibious aircraft. It was a rattle trap of an old thing with 4 engines high up. And I was sitting back in the tail end. There were some civilian passengers on it as well. But a group of us, about 10, I guess, got onto this plane, and we whooshed out of Hawaii over some great highways. I didn't know if we were going to make it or not. And finally, the thing got airborne, and it rattled and shook. I was wondering if we were ever going to make San Francisco, but by gosh, we finally got there, landed at Oakland. And it was foggy. We were flying up in the nice bright sunshine with lots of clouds below us. And we come down through the clouds, landed in Oakland Harbor, and we were met by a group of military men and taken in to take information taken down, and we were put on to see the station wagons, and a couple of girls drove us. They were driving the station wagons, and they didn't know where the hospital was, where we were supposed to go. So we drove all day around San Francisco trying to find this hospital. Eventually we got there, and they took us in and got us a bed and food, and we got passes to go out, and they had buses which took us downtown to the entertainment centers that they had for the troops. And we went down to these entertainment, and we had a great time going to these different places. I think it was two or three nights. One night we got out on our own. We thought, well, we got some money. I think it was $10 a piece. And we also had the opportunity to phone home. Now, my folks didn't have a phone. But I told them, it's no use. My folks haven't got a phone, or at least I didn't think they had. However, these girls went to work and got a hold of the Winnipeg police and asked for a neighbor of my mother's. So I guess they went down through the telephone book until they come to the B's, where they found somebody that lived on McIntosh Avenue, which was 8 or 10 houses down, and got through. So they went, got my mother to come to the phone, and I talked to my mother over the phone from a phone booth. It was set up in the Red Cross. This was all paid for by the Red Cross. And we were able to buy articles there very cheap. You know, the Army PX stores, there was no tax on it or something, and it was sold at very much reduced prices. And I bought a pencil set and a souvenir wallet and a few odds and ends. And I think that night we went downtown to visit the nightclubs. And one of the boys that was with us, he was a CSM, but he was connected with headquarters battalion. So he'd come from down Toronto, you see. He'd been a youngster, I guess, in the First World War. He had some idea of what goes on. And anyway, we went into this club, nightclub, and the liquor didn't seem to affect us. We could just drink the darn stuff like water. So Charlie, he told the waitress, call the manager over here. He said, look, we ordered a Tom Collins and it's got no taste to it. He says, haven't you done anything better than this? He says, we're a bunch of prisoners of the war and we would like a good drink. So the manager says, double Collins for these boys on the house. So they brought us a double Collins. So we drank a few more Collins and watched the floor show. They had some psychedelic lights on and girls with reflecting paint all costumed, you know, and dancing. And there was some comics put on and one thing or another. We got tired of this. We had no girls to mix with, so we went outside visiting bars and we went around. And I don't know, we drank a hell of a lot. None of us got drunk. And there was a curfew put on in San Francisco at that time because of the riots that took place on VJ Day. They all went haywire and smashed up everything, and they had a wild time. So that they had put a strict, and you had to be in at 12 o'clock. Now, we didn't know anything about this, but we could see military police walking around with their bands on. And of course, our uniforms were so mixed up, they didn't know who was connected with. So finally we found a restaurant that was open and we went in and had a big feed. And Charlie says, look, I'm not going to pay for this. He says, I'll collect it, don't you worry. So he gets the bill from the girl for the meals. He paid for the meals. And I don't know if he ever got an expense, but to knowing him, he would have worked it in somehow. And I think that was our last day in San Francisco. They loaded us on trains and sent us up to Vancouver, where they gave everybody uniforms, Canadian uniforms, new issue of everything. $300 and a check which could be sent to our home for any amount we wanted, you know, if I wasn't over our pay, back pay. So I said, can I get $1,000? And the fellow boxed me down for $1,000, and I thought this was tremendous, that this would be mailed to my home in Winnipeg. And some of the civilians came out to camp and took us for drives downtown Vancouver, and we got around, visited a bit, and got on the train to come back to Winnipeg. We came through Edmonton coming home, and I remember, and there was about 11 o'clock at night, and there was a half-hour stopover. So things were pretty dry on the train, pretty dead. We thought we'd get off and get something to drink. And so we got out, we got a taxi driver, and we was working to get a bottle of scotch. He says, that's $25. Holy smoke, we hit the roof. $25 for a bottle of scotch. How about some beer? Well, he says, you can get $12 a case. Well, that wasn't too bad, we thought. Okay, get us two cases of beer. So he drives us out to somewhere, and we get the two cases of beer. We get back into the cab, and one of the boys is with us. He's an awful hungry sort, so we pass the fish and chip stand. We got up some chips, so he stops. He goes in to order up fish and chips for everybody to take out. And he's waiting, and he's waiting, and we're waiting. We're wondering if we're going to make our train. And finally, comes running out with the stuff in his hands, and the taxi driver doesn't want to stop at the station because we got this beer in the cab, which is black market, and our bootleg. So he drove around the corner. So I got one case of beer, another fellow got a case of beer, put it over our shoulder, and we run like hell in through the station, through the crowd, past the police, right up onto the train, and slammed the beer under our bunk. Happened to beat the band. We just made it before the train pulled out.
And then he came back to Winnipeg.
So we had a few beers and some dated fish and chips, and then got home. We stopped at some small town in Alberta, or couldn't have been Alberta. One of the boys was from this particular town, postal corps boy, and the Red Cross ladies were out to give us chocolate bars and cigarettes, you see. Well, we wanted beer. So we headed across to the beer parlor. We disregarded these poor women who had come out so faithfully to greet us. We went across the beer parlor, downed a couple of beer, and then lined up. We could buy a half a dozen beer without a permit or anything, you know. And so everybody bought a half a dozen beer, and we headed back to the train, got back on the train, and come through to Winnipeg. Don't know, my parents were down to meet me at the station. Drove me home, and my dad had kept a bottle of rum, which I had brought back from Jamaica. But he brought this out to celebrate, and one of the boy's brothers, who was in prison camp with me, who hadn't returned with me, he was there, of course, to find out how his brother was making out, and we all got drunk together, and we had one whale of me that night.
On the morning of October 31st, 1943, at about 10:30 a.m. Pacific War Time, the Japanese news broadcast included a message from Japanese war prisoner Alexander Henderson of 162 McIntosh Avenue, Winnipeg, Manitoba.
This is Corporal Alex Henderson of Winnipeg Grenadiers, speaking to you from the Tokyo Prisoners of War Camp. Hello, Almut. Hello, Mother and Father. This opportunity to greet you, the rest of the family, and our many friends, with our own wealth of highly cherished and thankful. I sincerely hope for your health and happiness till I return. How is Jean, her baby and husband, Sam and his wife? I'm anxious about Alex, long for news. However, wish them all the very best of everything. Please send my love and regards to Molly. Hello, Jean Hatton. How often you are in my thoughts. Hello, San Antonio Mines. Regards to my friends in San Antonio. Dave Smith sends love and regards to Steve, his darling wife, his mother, father, and all his relations and friends. Yes, Anna. He has let me read a couple of your several letters. How lifting and appreciated even this small pleasure can be. It's beyond words, bringing us nearer to home and those we know. Dave and I are in general good health and spirits. Our mothers, wives, and sisters' cooking and baking have been discussed and praised to no end among us. We have contemplated meals, menus, and recipes from Eastern and Western Canada. Have great hopes of trying many new dishes and all of the old ones some of the time. The following men are well. Gordon Lowen, George Taylor, and Johnny Winkle of Richard Onan send regards to their families and friends. Art Lyons, Jack Campbell, Larry Mallord, and Art Dukes of Winnipeg send regards to mother, travel, dear ones, and friends. Time is short, my friends. Sorry I cannot mention you all. So, till we meet in person, may God bless you and keep you well. Amen.
That was Corporal Alexander Henderson. Alexander Henderson of Winnipeg, Manitoba, sending a message to family and friends in Manitoba, Canada. Manitoba, Canada.
Corporal Alex Henderson of Winnipeg Grenadiers. Hello, Alma. Hello, mother and father. This opportunity to greet you, the rest of the family, and our many friends, with my own voice is highly prized. How is Jean?
David's husband.
Sam and his wife. I am anxious about Alex. Long for me. However, wishing all the very best of everything. Please send my love and regards to Molly. Hello, Jean Haddon. How often are you in my thoughts? Hello, San Antonio Mines. Regards to my friends and fellow miners. Dave Kirk sends love and regards to Steve, his darling wife, his mother, father, and all his relations and friends. Yes, Anna. He has let me read a couple of your several letters. How lifting and appreciative even this small pleasure can be. Beyond words, bringing us nearer to home and those we know. Dave and I are in general good health and spirits. Our mothers, wives, cooking and baking has been discussed and praised to no end of money. We have talked and traded meals, numbers, and recipes from Eastern and Western Canada. A great hope to find many new dishes in all of the area and some of the time. The following men are well. Jordan Lowen, George Carroll, and Johnny Zinko of East Kildonan send regards to their families and friends. Art Lyons, Jack Chandler, Larry Mallord, and Art Dukes of Winnipeg send regards to mother. This opportunity to greet you, the rest of the family, and our many friends, with my own voice is highly prized and appreciated. My sincere hope for your health and happiness till I return. How is Jean, her babies and husband, Sam and his wife? I am anxious about ours, long for me. However, wishing all the very best of everything. Please send my love and regards to Molly.
Hello, Jean Haddon.
How often are you in my thoughts?
Hello, San Antonio Mines.
Regards to my friends and fellow miners. Those first sends love and regards to Steve, his darling wife, his mother, father, and all his relations and friends. Yes, Anna, you have let me read a couple of your several letters. How lifting and appreciated even this small pleasure can be. Beyond words, bringing us nearer to home and those we know. Greg and I are in general good health and spirits.
our mothers, wives, and sisters cooking and baking have been discussed and praised to no end among us. We have talked and traded meals, menus, and recipes from Eastern and Western Canada. A great host of found many new dishes and all of the old ones when we return. The following men are well. Greg Law, Doug Harris, and Johnny Winkler of East Bologna send regards to their families and friends. Art Lyons, Jack Campbell, Larry Millard, and Art Beach of Winnipeg send regards to mother, father, dear ones, and friends. Time is short, dear friends. Though I cannot mention you all.
And
God bless you. And keep you well. So long.
This opportunity to greet you, the rest of the family, and our many friends, that my own voice is highly prized and appreciated. I sincerely hope to see your health and happiness till I return. How is Jean, her babies and husband, Sam and his wife? I am anxious about Alex, long for news. However, wish them all the very best of everything. Please send my love and regards to Molly. Hello, Jean Haddon. How often you are in my thoughts. Hello, San Antonio Mine. About my friends and fellow miners. Dave Smith sends love and regards to Steve, his darling wife, his mother, father, and all his relations and friends. Yes, Anna, you have let me read a couple of your several letters. How lifting and appreciated even this small pleasure can be. It's beyond words, bringing us near to home and those we know. Joseph and I are in general good health and spirits. Our mothers, wives, and sisters cooking and baking have been discussed and praised to no end among us. We have packed and traded meals, menus, and recipes from Eastern and Western Canada. A great host of trying many new dishes and all of the old ones from the return. The following men are well. Gordon Lord, Doug Sherr, and Johnny Zinko of East Bologna send regards to their families and friends. Art Lyons,
Doug Campbell,
Larry Millard, and Art Beach of Winnipeg send regards to mothers, fathers, dear ones, and friends. Time is short, dear friends. Sorry I cannot mention you all. So, till we meet in person, may God bless you and keep you well. So long.
This is Radio Radio Recording, the Portable Station of the Broadcasting Corporation of Japan. And you have just heard the voice of Alexander.
How do you do, Mr. and Mrs. Henderson? This is Pearl Miner of the Wharf Business Recording Station speaking from 321 West 7th Street in Long Beach, California, Zone 2. The station was founded and owned by Eugene F. Shelby, now of the Signal Corps, United States Army, and dedicated to the comfort of the families of American and Canadian prisoners of war now held in Japan. On the reverse side of this transcription is a message sent by your son, who is a prisoner of war in the hands of the Japanese. It was recorded through our facilities June 17, 1944. This transcription is made possible through the contributions of others who, like yourself, have received recorded messages. War Prisoners Recording Station is a non-profit organization, and the operators of this service neither ask nor accept any compensation for their efforts. However, the actual expenses of operation average $1 per record, and your assistance in maintaining that average will assure the continuance of this service to others. Any additional contribution above that amount that you might feel able to make will be used in extending our services to those who are unable to bear their share of the expense. Checks or money orders should be made payable to War Prisoners Recording Station and not to any individual. It has been a pleasure to render the service to you, and we sincerely hope your loved one will return at an early date. In the meantime, we trust this message will serve in a great measure to relieve the anxiety which you have felt regarding the safety and welfare of your son.
This is Corporal Alex Anderson of Winnipeg Grenadiers. Thank you for the personal treatment of war council. Hello, Alex.
Hello, my little brothers.
This opportunity to greet you, the rest of the family, and our many friends, with my own voice, is highly prized and appreciated. I sincerely hope for your health and happiness till I return. How is soon for those who have been husband, son, and his wife? I'm anxious about Alex, long for you. However, wishing all the very best of everything. Please send my love and regards to Mary.
Hello, Jim Haddon. How often you are in my thoughts?
Hello, son, and tell me your mind. Regards to my friends and fellow miners. Bill Kirk sends loving regards to Steve, his darling wife, his mother, father, and all his relations and friends.
Yes, Anna. You have let me read a couple of your several letters.
I listened and appreciated even this small pleasure
can
do.
Beyond words, seeing our spirits are full and those we know.
Dave and I are in general good health and spirits. Our mothers, wives, and sisters cooking and baking have been discussed and friends to no end among us. We have passed and faded meals, memories, and recipes from Eastern and Western Canada. Our great hopes of trying many new dishes and all of the old ones when we return. The following men are well. Gordon Lone, George Taylor, and John Zinko of East Pavonis send regards to their families and friends. Art Lyons, Jack Campbell, Larry Mallard, and Matt Beach of Winnipeg send regards to mothers, fathers, dear ones, and friends.
Kind sources,
and well, I cannot miss you all. Both believe and faith in, and God bless you, and keep you well. So long.
So what was the voice of Alexander Henderson? Manitoba, Canada. Before we can conclude our personal information hour, we will be wondering if you can make this from the American Signals War.
this into a pot of water and put it, plug it into electric lights, and it would heat that pot of water to boiling, you see. So we used to heat our, boil our eggs that way and heat some of our rice dishes and use it to whatever advantage we could in cooking. I remember one time we had quite a big bucket, and I had made one of these electric heaters, and we had several cans that we were heating in this bucket of water, and it seemed to be taking such a long time that I was getting fed up with it. So I got a little bit of salt and I sprinkled it in the water. Well, this made it work twice as fast, but it used twice as much electricity and it blew the main fuse in the can. But we never got caught using these heaters. The Japanese interpreter who was there at the time, he was from Kamloops. He had gone to school, brought up in Kamloops, and he was about 16. He knew all our swear words and everything else, talked English like you or I. And he used to come around, most hideous little bastard. And when we were counting, he'd just over the head with our his sword all the way down the line. 1, 2, 3, 4, you see, and numbered us off. But he used to come out at night, there'd be no lights on. We'd all be standing around in groups talking. And he'd come out there without his uniform on and listen into our conversations. So we had to watch what the hell we were saying and who was around, or we'd get into trouble. I can't think of his name right now. The Kamloops Kid, we called him. But we'd be marching to the airport on work party, and he'd, "Keep your eyes off those girls, you white bastards. You can only go home and pull your wires anyway, you know." So we weren't capable of doing anything, but it was just if we saw some civilians on the street, it was kind of attractive. We saw many earlier in the time, we saw the Chinese that had been bedding down and bombed out buildings and broken buildings and things that had no place else to go. Some were dead, some were just hanging around. There were some of the Australians or that were there. They had got together and attempted to build a radio. And they'd got hold of some radio parts, but they were short of condensers, and they tried to make some, but it wasn't very too successful. I don't know if they ever got the thing completed or not, but they were trying to build a radio so we could get some outside. And I heard that the only way to escape from Sham Shapo would be a mass escape for the Chinese to be involved in it so that we could all go at once, because anybody who remained behind would suffer, you see. If somebody escaped, their policy was to cause those who remained to suffer. At that north point, they cut off our medical supplies, they cut down our food rations, they did a whole lot of things after these boys escaped that made our life miserable for us. But oh, we took it all in good stead. And finally, they come around and released the leaders of the huts back into the camp. Hadn't done them any harm. They had just imprisoned them separately for some building for a while.
I heard that they took all the senior officers and sent them to another camp, or took them away, or something. Was that while you were in Sham Shapo?
In Sham Shapo, we finally got organized. The officers got together, and they got their companies together under a sergeant major, and we got huts where each company got in their huts under a bit of military arrangement. But at first, it was just a hodgepodge because they were bringing men in from everywhere and everybody was mixed up. And there was no regulations or rules or anything laid down. And the food that come in, well, we went and got it the best way we could. They brought in a bunch of live pigs one time. They had quite a job, about a half a dozen live pigs, chasing them all over camp, catching them, killing them, cleaning them, getting them ready to cook them. I didn't have any part of this, but I remember the pigs coming in, and in the way of food, However, once they got organized, and our regiment Sergeant Major, he was appointed Sergeant Major of the camp. And he had to get a list of everybody in that camp. Now, this was so that we would have something to go on.
Remember who that was?
Paddy Keenan. Oh, yeah. RSM Paddy Keenan. He lives over not too far from here. And so he went around. It was a bit of jealousy about this, he was telling me on the quiet. The other sergeant, the RSMs, felt that they should have had the job. He says, but he can just see our colonel, when they asked for a man, speaking up, I've got just the man for the job, you can have Paddy Keenan do this, you know. So anyway, he got stuck with the job to keep the record of all the prisoners in the camp. And so he got the other sergeant major's cooperation, and they took down the names and numbers of their particular battalions, and Paddy took down all the names and numbers of those in our battalion, and he kept the list of the whole camp of who was captured and how, what condition they were in, if they were wounded or sick in hospital or just how they were. And somehow or other, we managed to get a list of all the dead. And some who died in battle, some who were missing, some who were... Where this list come from, I don't know. I got a copy of a whole bunch of names that I had forgotten, actually, but fellas who died in hospital, fellas who were still in hospital, and... when a ration truck would go up to hospital, it would bring back rumors of various kinds and spread around the camp and raise our hopes. And so early in the war, somebody got a bright idea if we made up a pool. Everybody put in a date of when the war would be ended. And this was sometime perhaps in January. So we quarter a piece or 10 cents a piece when we got the money, you see. We would, so everybody put down their hopeful date, and it ranged from May, somebody had put in as early as May, until as late as September the 28th, I think. Or was it September the 31st, which there is no such date. However, this was our hopes. It was some crazy guy had taken the September date. He had been know what he was thinking about, the way we felt, you know, because we never looked that far ahead. We never accepted the fact we would be prisoners so long.
You were all in the same year, May to September in the same
year?
Yeah,
1943. However, this pool fell through, and the time went by, and who was discarded. Another one was never arranged that I know of with our group. However, Christmas came and we got our $10 from the Kennedy King, and we got some extra rations and some clothing from the African Red Cross, I believe it was. With some extra rations to come in, which were divvied up for a Christmas dinner, and we had a bit of a Christmas celebration, and one of the boys, he was quite a good singer, he sang some Christmas songs, and then after Christmas, this would be in January, I guess they called for men to go over to Japan on work parties. And they lined us all up on one side of the road, marched us across the road one by one, and if you were able to make it, you were able to go on. I had a skin diphtheria, they call it. Oh, I was going to tell you about the diphtheria epidemic. They used to blow the bugle from the last post whenever somebody died, see? And they'd bring in a coffin and take him out the gate. But when the theory epidemic broke out, there were so many dying each time
that they quit blowing the bugle. Hospital facilities were very poor, and they had no way of treating any sicknesses or anything. And they were just sneaking these dead out so not to affect the morale of the camp. And then the Japs come around and start taking swabs to find out who were the fear carriers. And they sorted us all out, and I was one of the carriers. I didn't take the fear, but I was a diphtheria carrier. And I had broken out in a lot of scabs and sores on my legs. Tropical ulcers, they call them. And we had nothing to treat them with. However, they put us all into a confined area, barbed wire around it, and we were stuck over there in these huts and forgotten about it. We were lucky to get our rations. And I couldn't move. My legs were so bad that I couldn't. I had laid in bed all day. And they never had a bowel movement for ages, I don't know. But somebody would go over to the fence, pick up our rations and our hot water, which was cold by this time. We'd be carried over by the from the cookhouse and set over the fence into us, you see. And then some of these fellows that were acting as orderlies would come and bring us food around to us, and so we did get our food. But I remember lying in bed, and there was a shower room just down the way from me, and this doggone water running constantly. It just sounded like steak frying to me. It was torture. But these orderlies had decided that they were going to do something for me.
Were these Japanese?
They were English, British. Mm-hmm. And they thought they would pull these scabs off of my legs, which wouldn't let them heal. So they got me out of the bed and took me into a little screened-in room with a table in it, and they laid me out on this table. I was stripped bare naked. I was dreading this terribly because it looked very painful. And down to the flying tigers.